Hey everybody, welcome to Crew Call 2-3, March 2020. And I'm here with Imran. Forgive me if I murder your name, but I didn't even ask you exactly how to pronounce it, but I'm going to say Papierkiewicz. How's that?
That sounds good.
Close enough. Okay. Ron is someone that I met through a mutual friend. He's a Reading and Northern Railroad engineer. And he also has a great model railroad, and we'll talk about his railroad and my railroad and some prototype kinds of things. Ron was introduced to me by our mutual friend Tony V when he was a Reading and Northern engineer, and some of you might recall Tony V is the fellow that had back in the day gotten me a tour of Pittston Yard. And when my buddy Dave and I are down there with Tony, he said, "Hey, you know, you should come see my my buddy Ron's N-scale layout. I think it'll surprise you." And he was right. So, Ron, welcome to the call.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks for asking me.
You have a I guess a normal Monday through Friday schedule.
Yeah, Monday to Friday, working the Kaiser Valley branch, which is of interest to you, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. Kaiser Valley branch, for anybody who doesn't know, is basically accessed off the former Conrail Taylor Secondary, and is basically, how would you describe it? Is it part of Taylor, the town?
No, it's in itself a running track after you get through Taylor. When we leave the former Lehigh Valley Coxton Yards, now Pittston Yards, we go up part of the DLNW Bloomsburg branch, which is now our Scranton branch.
Okay.
And the Scranton branch will take us into Taylor Yard, which is the Norfolk Southern facility. And we get permission to go through that. And then we're on the Scranton running track, which is the line in question, all the Kaiser Valley branch area.
But just to be clear, is it the same track as what was known in my era as Conrail's Taylor Secondary?
The Scranton branch part is the Taylor Secondary, and that's just between Coxton and Taylor.
Right.
And then
you get to Manuka Junction, mm-hmm. You're on what you're talking about, right?
Right, correct. Then you have to go through Taylor Yard, which Conrail gave to the D&H at the time you're modeling, and they had trackage rights through Taylor, and then onto their Kaiser Valley Industrial, or Stauffer Industrial Park as it's known too.
Right. Well, I guess it's actually two different parks that are accessed via the same line, right?
Yes.
And that industrial park has been around a long time. I don't know how far back it goes, but I imagine it's like everything else in that area, a former coal field, right?
Lots of anthracite history. I'm a railroad history buff, especially when it comes to local things. And it's a very strange area in that there's not a lot of info available except early 1900s, mostly from the Steamtown Archives photos.
Okay.
And then there seems to be a huge gap of really nothing. I've seen maybe one Conrail photo shifting an industry back there. And then up to modern times, Reading and Northern photos are available. But there was a big gap where it wasn't documented very much.
I guess it was probably an area that certainly during my modeling decade, you know, the 80s, going in the wrong direction, you know, a period of decline, and I guess people just weren't that interested in it. So there's a very small number of people who know everything I need to know, and I have turned over rocks trying to find these people, and Ron, you're one of them.
Yeah, even the people that seem to know a little bit about it can't find much. It's it was a heavy industrial hub for anthracite. When you look at the photos from the early 1900s, you could literally see one breaker facility from the next,
right?
And down the line, and washeries, and there was also a large yard back there, which was the DL&W Hampton Yard. And I believe it was around 1969 that the industrial park idea began with the
Sure.
Erie Lackawanna. And the Hampton Yard was removed, and they started building warehouses for cane distribution. And that's how it grew and eventually became the industrial park it is now.
Basically, all my information has come from people like yourself and Tony V and Ed Philbin and Mike Bednar. I mean, I can literally count them on one hand. And you know what? Without making those connections and without the generous help of folks like that, I'd basically be completely winging it. As it stands now, actually, on the podcast group, Bobby Yerkanen, I think is his name. He's been very helpful too. There's a handful of people who are either from the area or know somebody who knows somebody and been able to contribute some things. But some information, boy, like we were talking the other day about the former Technoglass place in Jenkins.
Yes.
And by the way, I'm always a little confused between the terminology of Jenkins and Laurel Run. Is Jenkins in Laurel Run or the adjacent towns? Like what, how does it work there? Do you know?
Timetable wise, Jenkins would be further west than Laurel Run.
Okay. So if you're leaving, so to turn that around, if you're coming from Pittston Yard, you'll hit Jenkins before you hit Laurel Run.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And Mountaintop would be before Jenkins, right?
Mountaintop would be after Jenkins, at the top of the climb of the grade.
After
The grade starts
Jenkins.
at Coxton, and you start climbing the mountain, and
Right?
you would hit Jenkins first, which is
Oh,
where
right. Then
Technoglass is.
Mountaintop, then Laurel Run.
No, Laurel Run first,
Okay.
and then Mountaintop, obviously the top of the grade by
Right.
the name.
And this is all, of course, the former Great Lehigh Valley Main Line that became the Conrail Lehigh Line. And we've talked about it a lot on the show, and parts of it are still in heavy use this day by Norfolk Southern, right?
Up until about a week or about a month ago, the road trains from Norfolk Southern stopped running. I didn't even know if you heard about this yet, but they stopped running their road trains over the old Lehigh Line, and they're running everything down to Harrisburg over the old Pennsylvania line down through Buttonwood, the Sunbury Secondary that way. So
Does that even include the trains that used to run, say after Musconetcong Tunnel, I mean, heading into New Jersey? I mean, is that they're still using that portion, right?
I believe they're still using that portion for different things. That area is busy, but between Lehighton and Coxton, if we're talking about the old Lehigh Valley, right now it's just us. It was a big change to see you hear about all these changes in railroading, and I started for the Reading and Northern 20 years ago, and
Right.
that was probably one of the biggest changes as far as traffic shifting that I've seen since I've been there.
Now, what is driving that, do you think? Is it the so-called precision railroading or lack of traffic, or what do you, if you're just what do you think is
I believe
causing all
it's
that?
all precision. I believe it's all the precision railroading. Yeah, they
Right.
has something to do with the way they plan that, which is very elusive to a lot of people. Maybe
Even
someday we'll understand
the people planning it sounds like.
it. Yeah.
And you guys have a nice brand new spanking bridge, don't you?
Yeah, a new bridge, and
I've seen some
the Lehigh Line
amazing
is.
aerial footage of trains on that, like the first train on it, I think I saw a great drone set of footage of that. It was very impressive looking.
Yeah, I believe that was one of our employees that actually filmed that, but
Ah, okay. Now, can you describe, not only for my benefit, but for everybody's benefit, why, what was the purpose of that bridge? It doesn't really replace anything. It's a new connection, correct?
it's so trains flowing from the Reading Division to the Lehigh Division don't have to run around their train. There's no runaround move. They could leave Reading and come all the way up to Pittston and it's just one flowing move. There's no stop to run around in reverse.
It's basically a giant Y, right?
Yeah.
Very impressive. Have you had occasion to run over it?
Not yet. No, I haven't been over the new section yet. The old section, obviously, but not yet for the new section.
Right. So you've been on the local you were talking about for the Kaiser Valley for how long now? I mean, several years.
Must be around 4 years by now since I'm back on that. I was working the local to Mahoopany before that.
Oh, no
And then,
kidding. That's the one I got to ride on several years ago. That was actually, that's considered a pretty good job, isn't it?
yeah, that's a nice job because you have the 30-mile run up the line
Right.
to Mahoopany and then back,
The time I
and all your
did it.
work is concentrated,
Right. And you do Ransom also, of course.
Yeah, our new warehouse in Ransom.
Right. Now, the day I got to do it, it was like a stupendous, I don't know if it was late September or early October fall day, but you know, we had the cab door open, cruising back and just going along the river there. And I just thought, wow, you know, if the conditions were always like this, I could get used to it, but I'll bet it's a different story in the winter.
It still could be nice. The Lehigh Valley as a whole had some really nice scenery on the main line between that part of it and the Lehigh Gorge. It was a very scenic line.
And have you run over the mountain yourself? Have you had that job?
Yes, over the from Pittston to Lehighton, when that was still running, I ran that for 3.5 years, maybe.
That's PILE.
Yeah, as an engineer. And before that, I ran it as a conductor a long time ago also. But that job has changed with the times of what it used to start out of Penobscot or Mountaintop at one time. Now then it started out of Pittston, and now it's starting out of Redding.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it, okay, interesting. So when you do this Kaiser Valley job, is it the same every day or do you do different things on different days?
The customers, some customers will have a shift every day and other ones will be on certain days. But I don't think they're held to that, but you kind of know what to expect on certain days. The
Well,
shifts are
you
usually
guys are
different.
very service oriented, obviously, but I was just wondering, like at one time in my modeling era, Conrail, I think, went to Kaiser Valley 3 days a week, and the other 2 days they went to Scranton, I think, to do Chamberlain and Tolley High.
Oh yeah, they had the trackage rights up through Taylor to
Right.
work in where Steamtown is now. Yeah.
That's all DLW now, right?
Right. And the Kaiser Valley branch is all XDLW also, but yeah, it's 6 day a week service to the Kaiser Valley
Wow.
for us. So yeah, it's a busy place. A chain it you know Traffic has definitely increased since I started in 2000.
Sure.
We seem to do a good job with building the traffic base once we get a line.
What would you normally use for power on that?
Usually two SD40s, but there are times when SD50s get mixed in.
Yep. So it's heavy road power going up there. Is that partly because of the grade?
Partly, yeah. I would say mainly because of the grade and also because some of the customers get pretty big drafts of cars in, and they're also on the grade, so
Right,
it
right.
makes
Well,
it
there's a lot of plastics going in there, and I guess lumber and
warehouse, lots of
right.
warehouses too,
So
so yeah.
like beverages and food and that kind of thing.
Correct, yep.
Right. So it's always a heavy train.
Yeah, for the most part.
I mean, I had heard that back in my modeling era, that train would often have helpers. Like if the mountain helpers were sitting around in Pittston, they'd help shove it up the hill.
I could see that. I could see that because I know when the DLW had it, sometimes they added helpers at Pittston to get to Scranton, the rest of the way to the Scranton. Between Pittston and Scranton area, there is definitely a challenging grade at some points.
Do you have any idea what the grade is there?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't know the exact numbers on it. And I don't think it's steady.
Right. I mean,
You know,
obviously there's
but.
a ruling grade somewhere there, but nobody
Right.
seems to know what that is. They just know that I think it's short, relatively short and relatively steep. And you can kind of tell as you start driving up through Old Forge and all that, you can see it.
Oh, yeah. Although if you're on the road, you could see it, how blatantly it goes up
Right.
alongside you.
Right. And it does the same thing on my layout. I had a nearly impossible task to try to represent all of the areas that I wanted to include. And I wanted to include these areas because of the traffic. You know what I mean? When you think about the spaghetti bowl of track in that area, I thought if I could capture a subset of that, what would be so interesting are the various options, particularly when you're talking about how the P and E moved around. And speaking of people who have given valuable information, a buddy of mine, Ken McCrory, referred me to another fellow who used to work for the P and E, and in fact, he had done the initial survey of track and customers when the P and E started out, and he actually sent me the spreadsheet that he created to track all of that info. In fact, if you'd like to see it, I'll be happy to send it to you. It's fascinating.
Oh, that's interesting to me. I believe it all began in 82 and 83,
Exactly.
and it was a lot of abandoned coal trackage, and especially after coal had left the area, there was little segments everywhere, and it's hard to trace the history of it. I remember asking Pocono Northeast way before I started for the railroad if they even had any maps of their own line, and they couldn't answer it. So. Right at their
Fairly
office.
loose operation, I think. The only maps really that exist, I think, is former Conrail stuff. And I may have mentioned to you once that multimodal ways, you probably have been to that site. That's where all the Conrail ZTS maps come from, as giant PDFs. They had one map there that was the entire region. And it's an extremely high-res PDF that when I printed it, I think I printed it on, it must have been 12 different pieces of paper that I cut up and taped together. And it was only when I did that and laid it all out on the kitchen table that I could really get in my head what was going where. And one of the cool things about it was it actually was done at a time when stuff was being spun off to the P&E. So all of that was notated with dates right on this map. So it was probably like a, maybe a late 80s map, So this thing is gold. I would just would have not have been able to come up with an intelligent track plan, without this. Have you ever seen that one?
I haven't, but I mean, the further you go back, the more complicated it gets. I have a
Exactly.
map that's an old Erie map that it wouldn't, if I rolled it out, it wouldn't even fit in the room I'm standing in now. And it
Really?
has the whole valley from up near Carbondale all the way down to the other way near towards Nanticoke, and it's a maze of lines. I believe it's the one that trains. Magazine shrunk down to do the whole they did a story on the Wyoming Valley, and lots of people refer to that map.
Right, it's a greatly simplified map, but I think I know which one you're talking about. It's in full color, and that helps because.
Yeah, to me, I think that the Trains Magazine used that info to get what they had because it shows all the different trackage rights where all the different railroads had over each other just to get through anthracite mines and. It was complicated in that a breaker or mine facility could be on the Lehigh Valley, but it was only allowed to be served by the Erie.
Huh.
So the switch would be off the Lehigh Valley, and so would the customer, but the Erie would have to come on somewhere and use trackage rights to get to it, and the Lehigh Valley wouldn't shift it. And that occurred a lot throughout the Wyoming Valley.
And
So.
was the reverse also true sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes there were joint operations, but as far as the operators and who they were served by, it really got complicated, and already it was complicated by how much trackage there was because every railroad wanted to get their hand in every mine that they could,
Sure.
obviously, the competition for, customers. And then on the top of the fact that sometimes you'll see the mine on a railroad and you'll assume, oh, well, it's off the D&H, so it must be a D&H customer. But no, sometimes that wasn't the case either.
Well, it's all about the traffic, right?
Yeah, the traffic was all anthracite driven, and that was all the case until the Knox Mine disaster in 1959.
Right. Ed actually did a nice article on that in that was Trains, was it?
Yeah, I did believe it was Trains Magazine, and
Yeah.
Ed, I grew up with Ed. I've known him since high school, and
Oh, gosh.
he was probably the first guy I met that was into railroads and railroad history. And before that, I didn't think there was anybody that was interested in trains or history. So yeah.
He actually had referred me to several other interesting people too, guys like Greg Gunshore and
Oh,
others, you
Greg,
know.
yeah.
But
Yeah.
Ed was the first guy I saw that commuted to work on his bike.
Yeah, he lived close enough to do that, and he went, hey, if he wants to stay in shape and ride his bike to work, more power to him,
It's a good combination, actually.
Yeah.
When my buddy Dave and I first started driving around down there, I mean, I was trying to get to know the area a little bit better, and it looked interesting to me, but at the time, with the incarnation of my layout, I didn't even have room for Pittston Yard, and it was only after the first big rebuild that I had room for Pittston Yard, and that's when I started posting some questions about that, and that's when Tony V reached out to me, and my buddy Dave and I would drive around down there, and we thought we had a handle on what we were looking at, and then we'd cross another track and we'd say, who the heck's track is this? You know what I mean? It was, you'd go down a road and you'd cross three different railroads and you'd think, how the heck does this all connect together? It was very difficult to get a handle on just driving around, which, it reminded me of the Oak Island area in New Jersey. I was perennially lost around there back in the day trying to rail fan it back in the 90s, you know?
So, question for you about your layout. You have your version of Pittston Yard,
Yes.
and Pocono Northeast will, I assume, be coming in for interchange to do their own customers.
Correct. So Pocono Northeast on my layout has connections at Avoca at oh, what's that other junction?
Duryea.
Nope, that's their connection to Conrail, the D&H side on the other side of Kerr McGee.
Landcliff.
Yes, thank you. I was drawing a complete blank there. So they will occasionally go by Langcliff over to Taylor. They have that option. But most of the time they'll access Taylor via the Taylor secondary. So
Okay.
I'm representing a just a smidgen of Avoca Yard, which will really be used as PNE staging for all of the. And there's not a lot of them, but there's a handful of PNE customers that they accessed up that end. The sort of the I guess that's be the north end of the PNE, right?
Yeah, and by the time the PNE was doing its thing, there wasn't much left of Avoca Yard. So
Right.
I saw the
Track or
pictures
two.
on that you have, and that's more than enough to represent it. So you're doing good already.
Yeah, it's probably one too many, but because I'm using it as basically, like a PNE crew is never going to really switch at Avoca Yard, and two tracks probably would have been enough, but each session will start out with a PNE crew, with cars that I will have manually placed there off layout, so they can head south at Diriyah Junction and go over to Pittston and do some interchange work there, and then head around the Y and go down their own trackage heading south there. So that's all, of course, to come. I just on that whole south section off the Y, I just have a couple of tracks and a runaround there right now just to represent what'll come in the future. But the ability of the PNE to kind of run all over the place via trackage rights is very attractive to me.
Yeah,
I
I
just
could
think
see
it's
that
cool.
working. Yeah.
I have the SW1 that we've been using right along, and I just got in from my buddy Bob Harper the GP9 that they had, and I have on the bench the Conrail Blue NW2 that really just needs some final work. I'm trying to decide how much do I want to go in terms of detailing on that unit, because the Cato model that I'm using, you know, it doesn't have roller bearings, and you know, you need the cooling coils on the outside of the fuel tank, and you know, that ends up being, you know, something you look at and go, yeah, I'll get back to that, and then it just sits in its little box, half assembled, you know.
Yeah. Well, one of the big customers that I remember, and when Pocono Northeast was doing their thing in my area, I was still riding my dirt bike around to chase them. I was pretty young, but they would come up to a town near Houston, which was next town over from Avoca, to shift Scranton Lithograph, who made TV guides.
Really?
Printed TV guides, yeah. And they would get four CNN boxcars, usually four in, and pull the empties out and go back. They would leave Avoca pulling, and then they would shift the customer and have to shove back to Avoca. And I think it was probably at the most 3 miles or so, maybe
so
four.
These were CN cars, but not newsprint cars, right? Or were they?
I would see some CP also in there.
Yep.
I can't remember if they were newsprint, because at that time I was so young, I didn't know the difference between, you know, what the cars were. I was just happy to see a train going. But I do remember the CNN, and also another very undocumented operation, the Pocono Northeast.
Absolutely. You mean you're not going to surprise me with some photos that you yank out of a drawer somewhere?
I may. Now that you've got me back into interest, Wallace, I'm watching the photos come up on your Facebook page of the layout. Sometimes it rings a bell, and I look and I think, oh, I do have a photo of that somewhere. That's what happened to me the other day when I sent you the creosote operation.
That was stunning. I mean, my jaw literally dropped when I saw those, because I thought, oh my God, you know, I have been chasing photos of that place forever. And I basically decided I was just going to model it based on descriptions from Bobby Y, because he had, I guess, ridden the Conrail switcher in there a few times and was very familiar with it. So a lot of what I did was just a verbal description from him, plus, you know, whatever I could glean from the ZTS maps. When you look for information online, it's really scarce. There's more info about it as a Superfund site than anything else.
Right. That's usually when you search it, that's what you'll find about the lawsuits and it being a Superfund site.
Sure.
But my grandparents lived really close to there. And one day we had a relative in from the Niagara Falls area who happened to like taking pictures of trains. So he said, you guys want to go for a walk and take some pictures of trains? And that's how I got those photos.
Awesome.
We were down there with them. And the Conrail Local came up. But one of the neat things about that line where it came off there at Avoca was it went over a wooden trestle to get into Keir McGee. And I used to walk down to it all the time when I was over at my grandparents. And I was talking to Bobby about that, and can't find any photos of it.
Is that Mill Creek that it would have crossed?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
And they the kids lit it on fire once, and they put it out, and they still used it after that. So it was a kind of a charred, very charred color.
Unbelievable. My understanding is back in my day, with my modeling era, Mill Creek was a creek, and then later they kind of put it in that concrete trough that it's in now.
Yeah, that one photo, that's why I put that up for you on your page there, was at McAlpine Street. You could see how it was a tie wall.
Right.
That kept the track back from the creek. And that's where the flood project is now. So that area looks very different.
Well, was there like a particular hurricane or something that was responsible for the need to redo all of that?
Not that I recall a particular one, I think. And there was always some problems with that there. But
this area that I'm modeling all this in is a very strange, for me, a modeling project, because it represents an area that's maybe, I'll bet it's a good 80 square feet of model railroad, which for some people, and we'll talk about your railroad in a minute, that's their entire railroad. And most of us are modeling our railroads in such a way that mostly everything is within an arm's reach in from the aisle, more or less. You might have some background scenes and things that you don't need to physically reach that you build first. But in general, most model railroads aren't more than a couple of feet deep, give or take. This area, and my buddies, my ops buddies would really raise an eye when I would talk about this in the conceptual stage, because they're thinking, how the hell are you going to bring that off? You know, but I had a mental picture of it. But basically, this is a big, almost square area that is used to be where I had my Dartmouth Locomotive Works installation shop. So when I cleared all of that into the new addition in a brand new shop, it really opened up a giant hunk of real estate. But basically, all of the tracks, so see if you can picture this. The DNH crosses onto this peninsula and basically is right along the edge of it, heading into the addition and into Taylor Yard, which is where that is. It crosses the Conrail Main at DuPont, and that's the first thing I built, and that's kind of like an opening between the original basement and the addition. So the Conrail, you come out of Pittston Yard, you come down the front wall of the addition, you go through this opening and under the DNH at DuPont, and that's sort of like on one deep edge of this area. And then in the middle of this area, you've got, well, actually, Kerr-McGee is just inside of the DNH as per the prototype. Avoca Yard is sort of in the middle of this peninsula and needed to be built first. And then sort of the little valley with the river, the Lackawanna River, where the Conrail Taylor Secondary comes up and joins that DNH at some point, that is more towards the inside of that wall. And I had to devise a pretty good sized hatch in order to access that area just in case. So it's an extremely deep seam, but my plan was to separate the seams with big thickets of trees and control the viewing angle so that in any one spot, you're not seeing the whole thing. As you move along, you're able to see a different portion of it and not see where you were previously. So you almost feel like you're going somewhere. It's kind of ambitious because I wasn't sure if it was going to work, but
The
it
best part
does.
about railroads with mountains and lots of trees is that ability to separate the scenes.
Exactly. And if you're, you know, if you're doing the desert or the Midwest, I think in many ways that's a lot more difficult. The thing that I underestimated was the sheer quantity of trees that would go into this. I thought I had a good bead on that based on modeling all of my treed hillsides to date. But I've never built a scene of this size, you know, and I think I underestimated how much of everything went into this area. I mean, just ground cover alone, I used an entire, well, it was 4 gallons, not a five, but it was like a Home Depot 5 gallon bucket with 4 gallons of sifted dirt. I used the whole thing on this area. And that's just dirt. That doesn't count all the cinders that were used and all the, you know, the static grass and you know, I've been ordering bags of ballast from Arizona Rock and Mineral for the DNH portion of it. I mean, it's just the sheer quantity of materials that's gone into this is surprised me. And just yesterday, I ordered 4 more giant cases of super trees to build.
Wow. And the dirt comes from your backyard?
Absolutely.
I like that. I'm intrigued by that part.
I go out there and dig it up and then take the bucket and shove it into the furnace room. And I just let it sit there, usually over the winter, just to dry out. And
Okay.
then, you know, once it dries out, the best way to do it really is to take it outside and sift it through a screen and get rid of the rocks and twigs and things like that. And you know, and then I put it through a kind of like a hand sifter just to get a little bit finer mix out of it. But that, you know, that works great. And the only downside to it is that you do it a lot. You know, I mean, to get 4 gallons of fine sifted dirt, you know, I mean, it's it that was probably, I bet that was 20 or more different sifting sessions.
Well, all my rocks come from the Kaiser Valley,
All
but
your rocks are all actual rocks?
I go to there's still a lot of areas back there that are mine dump type of area, so there can be very fine, parts of it that you could put in a bag and take home and then crush it up further, because obviously doing N scale, I got to break it down a little more
Yeah,
than it would be in
I would think
HO.
you, I would think you'd have a much trickier sifting task there. But I mean, your scenery just looks right. Let's talk about your layout a little bit. Why don't you give us the you know the overall concept of what it is? And one of the reasons I wanted to interview you for this, by the way, is that you're an actual modeler doing actual modeling on a regular basis. And I think I would when we're all done, I'm going to ask you to put a link to your railroad site on the podcast group so people can check it out.
Okay. Yeah, well, I decided that I wanted to do the Lehigh Valley between 1968 and 1976. And I was lucky enough that when I started for the Reading and Northern, there was Mike Bednar was still there, and we had Stu Miller, who were two former Lehigh Valley employees.
Okay.
And Mike has been just an endless resource.
He
We're
has
always having
a
hour-long phone
vast,
conversations.
oh yeah, he's encyclopedic knowledge and also very generous with his time. I couldn't thank him enough.
Yeah, he's always helpful. And I didn't want to do a prototype railroad to match scenes perfectly, because I enjoy the part of the hobby where I could create. I enjoy scenery. I enjoy like the artistic outlet of it. So I like creating scenes, and it's fun for me to create a scene that didn't exist.
Well, but you know
So
what strikes me about the stuff that you're doing is it all looks absolutely authentic.
thank you. I like that whole process of creating the scene, and also I know that there are other modelers out there that have a hard time with that, but they literally have to be looking at a picture to create a scene, and sometimes we'll have conversations about that they can't build a part of a layout without following a photo, and they ask me, how do I do it? And I don't know. I don't know where it comes from, but that's one of
It's pure creativity. I think Mike Confalone is like that. You know, he's got a totally freelance layout, but he's got Maine in his head, so he can, like, you've got Pennsylvania in your head, you know, and he can extrapolate from there. I'm somewhere in between. I look at a lot of photos to remind me and to inspire me. But then it gets composed in my head, and until I compose it in my head, I can't build it.
Well, I got to tell you, Mike's layout is definitely an inspiration, and I could tell he's into that artistic part of it. He likes to create those really lifelike scenes. I
Exactly.
enjoy his stuff immensely.
Did you originally set out to be strictly N scale, or was there a debate involved in deciding what you were going to start with?
I did just because previously I had an N scale layout
Ah,
before
okay.
I'm in my current house. So I had all my Lehigh Valley equipment, and the way with the model railroad industry is now, it seems if you don't get it when it comes out or pre-order it, you have a real hard time finding
No
anything.
question.
So if I was going to switch to, say, doing all D&H and had to go back through history and find all the Atlas engines that were released in D&H, I think it would be a real challenge to start over again,
I've had a little bit of that experience here too, because as a Conrail modeler throughout, I'm good stock on Conrail. You know, I have over 100 Conrail engines and plenty of rolling stock. But when I decided to incorporate the D&H, I had to really play some catch up. And fortunately, I've been able to purchase some items from other, you know, modeling friends. You know, I've got one from Jim Lincoln, and I've got you know, three or four from Neil Schofield and at least one from Mike Confalone. So that got me going in a way that I wasn't starting from scratch. So I get that.
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. And also, there was already a lot that I took the time to custom paint just because they were one offers. Every once in a while, the Lehigh Valley would do, you know, one or two engines in a certain scheme. And the paint shops that's there were very open to changing their colors and schemes all the time. So there were times where you just have to custom paint it or you're not going to wait until Atlas decides to do one engine of a certain type. But
how many locos do you think you have in service at this point?
I don't even have a number off the top of my head. I think I have just about at least one engine representing every class, or probably at least a four-unit lash up, or three-unit lash up, I should say, of each, you know, type of locomotive and each type of paint scheme. But there are a few that they haven't done in N-scale that I haven't had the ambition to kit bash, because at this point, you see how I work on my layout pretty steady, you mentioned, and I'm trying to keep going with scenery. And I really don't, at this point, like to stop and go back and start working on in cars and rolling stock unless there's a problem, unless I'm having derailments or
you find it's a different mindset. I do.
It does. And sometimes it's hard to like stop. I think one time I stopped to do a Baldwin switcher because I needed some switching power for what I call my Wilkston secondary. And I needed all of the stuff that was out on the market was very off color. It was, instead of Lehigh Valley Cornell red, it almost looked like a purple. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't deal with it being on the layout, and it looked terrible in photographs.
I wonder what causes that. We had that problem with some Conrail paint schemes from the early proto 2000s. Same issue, too purple.
Yeah, I don't know how their research and development teams work, but everybody for a while there that was putting out Lehigh Valley Corno Red was making purple engines, and I don't know how that was happening. But I think one of my theories are is that they were already so dirty and weathered in the photos they were going by.
Right.
That and maybe the type of photo. That it had lost the red completely.
Yeah, some color shift, exactly.
Yeah, that's one of my theories. And also,
scenery work is high impact, isn't it? I mean, you're not going to get more bang for your hourly buck, I think, than scenery work.
Yeah, I love to not only do the scenery, but then to photograph it. Obviously, you see a lot of photos on my site.
And videos.
And I enjoy that, you know, so... when I was doing my article for Model Railroad Planning, Tony Custer had mentioned that, you know, he's like, wow, it seems like whatever angle you take a photo from, it's a photogenic and, you know, angle. And I said, well, that's kind of because when I'm putting the scene together in my head, I'm already thinking of how is this going to work in a photograph.
That sounds like Ken Karlowitz.
Exactly. And it's funny because his article was in the same magazine that my article was in, so we could both definitely relate to that. And it makes a big difference, I think, when you try to picture the whole scene overall. And I know a lot of guys are into operations and they just want to get trains running, I understand that, but if you just sit back and try to picture the whole scene overall and how it's going to look, you'll be a lot happier later with how the photographs turn out. So that's another aspect I enjoy of that. And one of the things like I talk a lot about is a lot of guys that photograph their layouts, especially doing N-scale. I actually like to use my iPhone 10 for a lot of the photos. And the way you could get away with making a photo where everything is in focus using, you know, an iPhone is there's lots of free photo stacking software. You don't even have to pay for it. I use one called Combine ZP. And a lot of the photos you'll see on my page or that get turned in are actually maybe 24 photos with the focus moved. But the reason I like using the iPhone is because in N-scale, you could really get down to track level to look like you're taking a photograph from the point of a rail fan or someplace that looks realistic where it's not taken from a drone. and you could really get in there and take some good pictures, being that it's a smaller scale, get it to look more realistic with the results.
Do you do the editing right on your phone also, or do you have a?
No. I use an app. Actually, I should mention that I don't use the actual camera phone, in that it goes through an app on the phone to give it. It's called Lightroom, and it gives it a bit more of a, changes the settings on the camera.
Really? So it's controlling the camera.
Yes, it's controlling the camera, and you still have a problem with bringing, you know, the certain things that you would, features that you wouldn't have using a full-on big expensive camera. But when you take, you know, I put it on a tripod, and then I use a remote, a Bluetooth remote, to snap the photo, so I'm not moving it at all. And the only thing that I move is the focal point. So I may move the focal point 24 times and then just take the 24 photos when I'm down, put them on my computer, and load them into the photo stacking software. And they always seem to turn out pretty well as long as you don't move the camera.
It always seems like if you're not doing that, you don't have a chance at the depth of field that would mimic what your eye is seeing if you're standing there, and that's why your photos look so realistic. I think Lance Minheim was an early adopter of that kind of thing too.
Yeah, and I read about it actually because I did that article in Model Railroad Planning. We were talking about, because back then I didn't know about it, but I knew that I liked how I could get my iPhone into tiny places to take great photos, and I know Lance had that Monon and scale layout that was also really photogenic, you know. And so I figured there has to be a way to do this. And I think in Model Railroader, I saw some articles, and then I also saw YouTube videos out there. And they said, you know, the software is free. You just download it, and you know, I followed their process. And then it was a lot of trial and error. I'm not going to say that it's going to turn out perfect the first couple times you try it, if you try it. But
it
didn't take too long to get the hang of it. And by the time I turned in my next article, which isn't out yet, the photos were immensely better, and just the depth of field was all there. You know, everything was in focus, and it was such a big improvement looking back at my other older photos. So,
do you do that with all of the photos that you post on your group?
Yes, they're all of them are done with. Sometimes I, like, if I'm just describing how I'm doing scenery or something, I just snap a shot.
Yeah, like a culvert in process.
Yeah, like culvert in process. But if I'm doing one of my scenes and it's just a shot of the scenery, then I'm using that process where it's probably you're looking at 24 different photos combined together just for the depth of field. And the one thing you don't want to do is have, you know, just if you're into scenery, is take a photo and just the lead unit in the train is in focus and the rest is all blurry.
Yep.
You know, so
what, you know, before I get too far ahead here, I had meant to try to ask what the overall, you know, the overall layout concept is. You started talking about your modeling era, and we know the railroad, but you know, because it's N scale, it's a big N scale layout, and you do feel like you're going somewhere. Maybe just walk us through it a little bit.
Okay, so it all starts with a long 5-track staging yard, and I could probably fit, for the most part, 40 to 45 car trains in there, including like the 3 units, because most of my road trains have 3 units, which was very indicative of what was happening back then. And
is that a typical train length for you?
Yeah, somewhere around there. And
that means you have great track work.
Well, the track work I took a lot of time with because of the fact that I like scenery, because nobody likes to do a scene and then have to go back and start tearing out track because you're having derailments.
It's a nightmare.
So I took a long time with the track work, and I knew this was going to be a permanent layout. This wasn't going to be a layout that I'm going to tear down in a couple years and I'm going to start moving. So I really took a long time with the track work, and super elevated the curves for appearance. Everything on the main line is super elevated, and that also makes a very high impact on photographs when
Oh
you have
yeah.
that lean into a curve when you're taking a photo of a train.
Does it make operation more challenging or easier?
The super elevation you're talking about?
Yes.
I haven't had any problems with the super elevation, and I'm running, as far as derailments or anything like that, I'm running up a 2% grade in two different points, and I have S curves just like the Lehigh Valley Mountain Cutoff did, and
Sure.
I haven't had any points. I think there was one or two times when I was running a really long train before I started scaling it back to what will fit in the staging yard, where some of the flat cars just couldn't get the weight in them, and so they would almost
Streamline.
start to go up on two wheels like the Dukes of Hazzard in the middle of the train, but they would come back down, when the train came out of the curve.
Really?
Yeah, because I think it was, it was string lining basically was in
Right.
effect,
So
and
that was like a 50-car train.
even more than that, when I first started running the layout before I had this whole staging layout area, I was just running long trains basically to test the limits to see how many locomotives I could use to get, a train up to 2% grade and over the top,
Now,
And that was just.
I have found in HO that many cars are almost unfixable. In other words, I'll take like an Intermountain covered hopper, right? Everybody has a lot of those. And 95% of them will run just fine, but a couple or three, I don't know if it's because they have a twist to them or you can replace the trucks. You can do whatever you want to that car and it's never going to run exactly right in a big train. You find that in N-scale too?
I found an in scale, I wasn't having too many problems, but definitely changing everything over to metal wheels.
Right.
And the quality of the metal wheels in N scale has come a long way. And changing over to metal wheels and also making sure that everything has body mount couplers
Right.
definitely, is an improvement. But I can honestly say that before I did that stuff, I wasn't having many problems just running micro trains cars with truck mounted couplers in the beginning. It's only when you're shunting a big cut of cars, like say
Sure.
20 cars, that stuff really comes into play, the body mount couplers and the weight,
So
But
I don't recall from when I was at your place because it's like drinking from a fire hose. But do you use a dehumidifier?
I do. There's a large one under the layout and it runs all the time.
Okay.
I've had to change
Year
it
round.
once. Yes, it runs all the time year round, and I had to change it once to dehumidifier since I started to lay out about 10 years ago, and it wasn't because it broke the dehumidifier. I think I just got a notice that there was something
Recall.
wrong with it. Yeah, it was a recall. So that runs all the time,
I think,
and it's important.
I think dehumidification might be the single most important thing you can do to avoid humidity expansion and contraction. I tried an experiment last year with the new addition. I had a brand new central air conditioning system out there. And I didn't run the dehumidifier. I wanted to see what kind of a swing I would get and to see if that would do the trick. Answer, no. Did not do the trick. I've had my share of sun kinks that resulted from benchwork contraction as compared to when it was built. And that might have been also a function of, let's face it, lumber does dry out even if you're buying kiln dried. And what I haven't had any problems in the old section of the layout because all of that stuff has been engineered out. But I think I would probably need at least a couple more op sessions that I consider to be test op sessions before I declare it fully operational in all the new areas.
Yeah, Homo can wreak havoc if you're not constantly using dehumidification processes. And now I'm to the point where I'm using code 55 rail in N-scale, which is, you know, very prototypical, but it's also very small.
Yeah.
And it's going to, you're definitely going to get kinks and things if you have, you know, temperature changes, humidity changes. So I'm lucky that my basement pretty much stays the same temperature all year round. And it's actually nice to work in the summer and nice to work in the winter. And, but
creature comforts are important when you spend so much time down there, you know, and in fact,
yeah.
The first winter in the new addition, I thought I had ample, baseboard heat down there. And, I did not. It wasn't freezing, but I couldn't sit there in just a normal shirt and be completely comfortable working at my installed desk. And I actually had to install some of these. They're actually made in Poland. These aluminum radiators that are incredible. Had I known how nice these things were, I would have put them instead of, not in addition to the baseboard radiators. They're just the greatest thing. They give off a nice heat and keep giving off heat even after the, you know, the circuit kicks out. It's just, I don't know. I can't say enough about it, but that I'm a little older than you, Ron, and I don't like to be cold.
I don't appreciate being cold. I'm cold enough at work.
Exactly.
When I'm out in the elements working on the railroad.
At least you can dress for it.
You were point to point, correct? Your layout is all point to point?
It is.
Okay, so that was the one thing when I was engineering this layout, being a guy that goes out and shifts trains in real life all day long, I definitely wanted the option of continuous running because
sure.
I knew there would be days when I would just come home and enjoy watching the trains run and not having to do any of the work. But
old staging yard used to be a double-ended staging yard, and that proved to not be practical with the new scheme, because basically now I have three endpoints. You know, both railroads share Allentown staging as a south staging point, but I've got Sayre Yard staging as the Conrail north point, and I've got basically Binghamton staging on the DNH. So I've got three major staging yards, you know.
Okay.
Sayre and Binghamton both have four tracks, but they're pretty long. Allentown has eight tracks, and it's even longer. So, you never really have enough staging, and I just figure, you know what, with two railroads working here, I want to be able to do what I want to do. It's not like I'm modeling the middle division. You know what I mean? I mean,
basically
talking about on the low side, one Conrail road freight in each direction during a session, and sometimes two. DNH will have more through trains and a lot less switching, almost no switching.
Yeah, that was definitely what was going on back in that time. And with my five, I have a five track stub and staging. I wanted at the time my model, the Delaware and Hudson had trackage rights, just as they did in your time, going over the Lehigh Line. So I have one staging track with a DNH train built and ready to go.
Yep.
An E84, an E87. And then I have one with the Jersey Central train also, which did, you know, operations on the sections of the Lehigh Valley at the time. And those are through trains. They'll leave staging and they can either go east or west. And then when they come back to staging and they're at the end of the line, that they're done. They made their move. And I have a Apollo train that I run, which is the Hotshot Lehigh Valley piggyback train.
Yep.
At the time, and that's also a through train.
I think when we were visiting.
Oh yeah, that's usually a crowd favorite. They seem to like that one, especially since the Apollo was authorized to do 60 miles an hour where they could, even when the Lehigh Valley was in bankruptcy. So you could run them a little hotter if you want. And the other two tracks are Lehigh Valley road freights, and they're the ones that make set outs and pickups in the one scenic yard on the layout, the larger scenic layout.
Yep.
So I planned for having probably two road engineers. I don't want more trains on the layout than that. That's like, you know, seems to me at a time. So, you know, two trains will be out on the main line, two road train engineers, and when they get back into staging, other trains could go out as ones come in. And then there's a yard job where someone can shift the yard. And I have what's called the Wilkston secondary, which is where most of the industry is off, which is an industrial type of area, and that'll get shifted by its own job. And then there's
a little mini Kaiser Valley kind of a thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's a handful of customers off the main that probably can get either done by that same job or maybe have a road local. And for a large freight house that was heavily inspired by the freight house that used to be on the Lehigh Valley in Wilkes-Barre, PA. And that could get a decent amount of cars in and out, plus a piggyback ramp. So there's more than enough work to go around. But
have you had actual op sessions with multiple guys there running trains?
The first one was all, I think, all railroaders except for one person that was there. And since most of my friends just happen to be railroaders, probably because I've been working for the railroad for 20 years,
right,
when we come over, the operating method that I'm trying to implement is the same we use at work, which is a Form D,
yep,
even though it's not indicative of, you know, the train orders that were in use in the modeling period.
But you guys
it's
know
it's just
it.
Easier. We all know how to use them, so it's just easier, you know.
So do you basically, on a session like that, are you the dispatcher, basically?
Yeah, well, the first one I tried that, and it got hectic because it was everyone's first time finally, you know, coming, piling in and wanted to see everything and how trains run and everything, and you're trying to point things out. And I realized right away that if I was going to be the dispatcher and sit at the dispatcher's board, I had to actually concentrate on that.
That's right.
To route trains correctly and do everything. But the fun part was everybody got to run a train out of staging and around on their own and follow the main line. But we didn't do any local operations yet or anything like that. I still have to implement car card system. And as far as like what we've done so far is just come over and run road trains either east or west when they come out of staging, make sure that nobody runs into each other and they all get back to staging at the end of the track. So.
Yep.
We're getting there slowly, but
do you have an optimal number of people that you find is about right for your room?
I think with me dispatching, I think four or five other people involved in running trains is more than enough, you know.
It's interesting that you should say that, because that's about what we've found, you know. Even though I have a big layout, relatively speaking, it can absorb, you know, a higher number of operators, but then it's like herding cats. You know what I mean? You're trying to keep you're trying to keep a lot of people from just milling around, taking up space, and that's really not what I want to be doing in an op session. So we find about, you know, maybe five or six guys is about right. You know, we'll have one guy always at Mahoopany. And we'll have one guy always at Pittston Yard, and now we'll have somebody at Taylor. So there's three jobs right there. And you might have a couple of locals working. There's your group, you know what I mean? And it's nice to have other things to do when those guys are done doing what they're doing. Some of them, you know, obviously the locals will finish up. Things like a Kerr McGee run, you know, the Pittston job will run over and do that himself, which I believe is how they did it.
Yes, yes. And I think that's
some too,
also,
actually, back in the day.
That's how the railroad ran back then. You know, you're doing early Conrail or like mid Conrail?
84.
I didn't even ask you. 84. Okay. So, yeah, I mean, and I'm the end of the Lehigh Valley, which is right before that. And really, there wasn't back to back trains on the main line, and there wasn't an immense amount of locals out. So,
right.
Really,
we need
what
those
we're
main
doing,
line
we're running
trains.
It like it was.
Yeah, we need those mainline trains to keep Mahoopany and Pittston fluid. Otherwise, you know, you'll clog up pretty well. But we run WASY-10 south out of Sayre staging that does, you know, Towanda and Wyalusing and you know those areas. I think we've been having them do Laceyville also, and then we've also been fooling around with having the Mahoopany job go off and do Meshopin, the grain mill there at Kintner Milling, and also Skinner's Eddy, which anecdotally I've heard is something that had happened back in the day. So, you know, we fool around with it a little bit. There'll be one job that'll probably go down and do I always forget the name of the Intercities cold storage at Jenkins.
Oh, yeah, that was out of service when I started for the railroad, but the siding was still in, and now it's not, but I remember that siding being in.
In my era, there were actually three spots on one track there. There was Intercities and some food warehouse, were almost one contiguous building, but different spots. So you'd spot
Right, it was a very big building.
you'd spot a reefer or two at Intercities, and maybe an XM boxcar or something down at the food place down at the end of the track, and farther up towards the main line switch, there was a spot for a lumber company there. Can't remember offhand the name of the lumber company, but I'll occasionally spot a flat car or a box car with maybe a little ramp or something there, to unload it.
I believe it was 84 lumber in your era.
Might have been,
And
yeah.
then the siding was out for a long time, and we put it back in, and they're receiving cars again, not on a super regular basis, but they get cars now and then up at 84 lumber, and that's all that's left up there as far as all the rest of the customers are missing from Jenkins. But
Oh, even the cold storage place, yeah.
yeah, the building is still there, but no rail service, unfortunately.
Oh, brother. Well, I was intrigued when you told me that there was a truck dump that was in use at the industrial park in my era.
In Kaiser Valley, yes. When I started going out there before you got to the end of track, where there was a runaround, there was a track off to the right that had a truck dump. So I looked, walked around, looked at it, and I found it. And I have, once again, no photos, but it is on Conrail. Certain Conrail's ETS maps shows the
So
as it.
is it the kind of truck dump where they would spot just like a single 70
Yeah.
ton hopper or something?
Yeah, nothing big. I think, one or two at the most you could get alongside of it. It was a tie wall dump
Okay,
with
okay.
just dirt built up to it, nothing fancy, you know.
And literally a dump truck of coal would just back right up to it and dump it down into, so there must have been coal all over the ground there.
I started reading more into the area there the longer I've been working back there, and there was a mine up in that area near the runaround that kept running way after stuff closed in 1959 because of the Knox Mine disaster. They were still getting coal out of there, and it was harder and harder for them because they needed to constantly keep water out of the mines. So there was immense pumping stations that would pump all the groundwater out of the mine while they were working. And as more mines closed, they were all sharing and keeping these pumping stations working. And by the time that was the only one left, it wasn't economical enough for them to keep the whole thing system pumped out just for their one little mine that was left. So eventually it closed, but that kept going for, I want to say, close to the 70s.
So if I were going to model that, it would literally be off in one little corner, all overgrown,
Yes.
just a horrible condition piece of track, and a forlorn hopper sitting there with a wooden tie wall, the height of the hopper.
That's all it was. I'm sure there'd be just two Conrail hoppers placed at it, maybe one even, and not much coming out of it. It was when I looked back at older maps, it was a tail track to a coaling trestle that used to be there, where they would actually put the coal cars up on the trestle to unload them from underneath. There, that
Jeez.
was there. It, the tail track that was there for the mine dump track that we're talking about was like a switchback to get up that coaling trestle. So.
So was the track itself kind of elevated to, it wasn't on the same level as the park?
Not much, not much. Obviously the dump where the trucks had it back up on was elevated, but the track was not, no, it wasn't much higher than the main. So yeah, you could literally just put a branch off, a right-hand turnout, and make it probably good for, to make it look realistic, but for 5 to 7 cars, and just have a hopper spotted at it, and that would more than enough suffice to make that look good.
I like it. The work on the Kaiser Valley is probably going to be, 2021 work. What I'm trying to do is consolidate my gains at Avoca and DuPont, and I'm actually doing scenery now down into Jenkins. So
Okay.
I think that and that all happens in the old train room. You know what I mean? So before I open up any new fronts in this little constructing your model railroad war, I think I want to solidify, you know, where I am in the old train room. And then if I can get that happening, the only thing that remains is ransom. And I've been working on and off with Jimmy Simmons, formerly Monster Model Works, to try and get him to laser cut the mill at Ransom. And, you know, of course, Jimmy's sporadically available and always one of the busiest guys. And it's kind of up to him. But if he surprises me and that shows up someday, that'll shift my attention over to Ransom, because then that'll be, if he does the basically a custom kit for me to do that building, that whole scene will fall together pretty nicely. And if I get that done, that means that whole room is going to be presentable, which would be a big thing, you know? So I would like to think that that's 2020 work, you know what I mean? But really, you never know. You never know how it's going to go. You never know
right
how
now, how
is
many
is
locals
go.
Do you have out of Pittston Yard?
We do Ransom as a yard turn, which I had heard in my day. So
the ram job,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. And Tony was talking about how sometimes it would go out with cars on each side of the engine so that it could do the pulp track as well as the shipping and receiving, which I thought was kind of cool.
Right.
And then we'll run a separate local that goes out and does Tunkhannock.
Okay.
And then we run another local that will probably do that, you know, like I started to say this and then got sidetracked, but one local will go out of Pittston and do the, the Jenkins area. It'll do Technoglass and that intercity stuff. And I think we're going to make that, that's all that particular local does, because if you have a huge local, it makes it just unwieldy. You know what I mean? But I think in real life, that local also went on and did not the Kaiser Valley, but Crestwood.
Yes. Yeah. And even there was times in the Reading and Northern where we combined them. We'd start out of Pittston Yard and go up and shift. It was Owens, Illinois, and then Technoglass, and then go up to the Crestwood Industrial Park, shift them and return to Pittston.
Right. And that, Crestwood is like a future section of the layout to be built. Maybe it's towards the end of next year. Maybe it's the following year. Who knows? You know what I mean?
Do you ever feel overwhelmed with the size of your layout? That's my big question.
How do you eat a mountain? One bite at a time, right?
If you take it one bite at a time, I could see it being manageable, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the only way I can do it. So I've tried to design the not only the general scheme of things, but also the order of business in terms of building it. Because let's face it, I mean, I think you feel the same way. Building the layout is a lot of fun, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like I'm in any rush, really, to be done with forever anything that I'm doing right now. By the same token, the approach that I've taken so that I don't get bogged down is I like to get as much of the layout, what I call presentable, as soon as possible, rather than just, open bench work with track and sub road running through it. You know what I mean? That doesn't have much attraction to me. So by presentable, I mean, ground filled in and ground cover and maybe some rudimentary trees, and the track is ballasted. Not worrying as much about any super detailing, because you can always go back and do that to your heart's content. You know what I mean? So that's kind of been my focus. But what has been interesting and challenging about this section that I've been working on for a few months here now is that I had to get more super detailing done in areas that would not be all that accessible as I built my way out of it. I've never had to do that before. So a lot of thought had to go into the build order of this. You know what I mean? So if you look at the rear reaches of DuPont, it's basically done, and also the same for most of what you see about you know, of Avoca Yard and the lower reaches of the Taylor Secondary. I had to pretty much do what I was going to do there, so that I could then work my way out of that spot and do the areas that were closer to the aisle. So the only thing that's undone right now is stuff you can reach from the aisle.
And DuPont is very recognizable.
It's a signature scene, you know. The minute I
great job with that.
Thank you. You know, the minute I saw it in person, Tony took us down there. He said, "You got to see this." And I walked down there, and I just kind of put my hands in my hips and looked all around at it, and then just started taking pictures because I knew I had to model it. It was that visit that convinced me that I needed to find a way to get this into my operational scheme. And that
did
was
he tell you that was the focus of a Ripley's, believe it or not, story?
You know, if he did, I don't recall that. Maybe you can enlighten me here.
I just saw it again. I was always told that growing up, but then I just saw something on the internet the other day about a mention of it on one of, I think it might have been the Anthracite Historical Society, or one of the other ones, but it, I think it was the fact that so many bridges crossed each other, because obviously on the double track Lehigh Line, you did the one bridge that goes over the creek, how one bridge is, you know, one track is on the ground, one
yes.
is on the bridge.
Yes.
And then you had the D&H track above that. And then the
Route 11
road bridge,
above that, yep.
Right, and you did the green bridge there for Route 11. And then there's the Laurel Line double track bridge over the top of all of them.
Mercifully, that was not in my era.
right. That would have been a project. Yeah.
I know it. And, you know, it's even the prototype as I saw it was almost unbelievable. You know what I mean? It's just to see what they had to do there. But think about now from a railroad standpoint what you have to do to pull that off. You've got to get your grades right. You've got to make sure that it, you know, your whole scheme revolves around this spot. And that's basically what I did. I looked at what my issues were to try to create DuPont, and then spent weeks trying it in this spot, trying it in that spot. You know, and Pittston Junction was important to me. There's only so many places you can have a big Y like that. You know what I mean? So I spent a pretty interesting almost a year track planning to get it all all to work. And in fact, funny anecdote is that when they were building the addition, they had laid it out on the ground like the architect drew it up. And after they went home, I think that was like on a Friday, I went out there the next day and I took a stick and I started drawing in the benchwork. And I was comparing it to my drawing, and then I had this horrible realization where I realized something got lost in translation, and the building was 4 feet too short. And if they had built it as was, I wouldn't have been able to do Pittston Junction and have the whole P&E going down that side. So when they came back on Monday, I said, "Guys, we have to make this addition bigger." And I talked to the architect, and you know, and basically the thing was, we didn't think we were going to get any hassle from the building inspector, and the architect didn't even think he would need to redraw the plans, because basically you need plans to get your building permit, and then they come down and look at it and make sure they're happy with the quality of construction, right? But I took the better to ask forgiveness than permission approach, and basically we bounced it out. Nobody noticed, nobody cared, and I got the size layout room I needed.
Well, you would have definitely lost out on a lot of traffic if you had to skip Pittston Junction, so it was worth it.
Oh, I had to have it. I mean, you know, the Taylor Secondary comes out of there. I mean, my whole operational scheme required it. And just a couple of test op sessions we've done with it, it's just so much fun doing it, and to see the flexibility that you have and the options that you have. There's things I'm looking forward to there. You know, Tony got me very accurate dimensions of the yard office there. And of course, I've got all the pictures I need. So I'm building that to complete scale. And I've got all of the abutments and things I need from Russ Green at New England Brownstone to do the, you know, the bridge work there at Pittston Junction. And it's going to be a real challenge, I think, getting the right shade of orange for the river.
Oh yeah, an orange. Yeah, that's indicative of the whole mine area. But I like how, I mean, doing a layout your size, you have help, and there's people that help you with different aspects of it. And that's one thing I could say is a little different with mine, where you notice that I work on it steady, and I'm always doing update photos of where things are going. But everything on the layout has been me, from day one. No structure help, no rolling stock help, no scenery help. And I don't know if that's because I think that I liked having total control over it. But sometimes it got to the point where we were just talking about I don't like to stop scenery work to go back and start doing other things because then it kind of gets me off the mindset.
Sure.
Recently, I finally broke that whole thing, and I met a guy who actually came for a cab ride one day with the Reading and Northern, but his father works for the Lehigh Valley, and he just happens to own a weathering company called Centerpiece Rolling Stock, and he had his book with him, and he found out that I was a model railroader. Breezy mentioned it to him, and he showed me his book, and he does the Lehigh Valley cars to the point where he knew the car knockers that were working up in Sayre, and their chalk marks on the cars and everything very good. So he,
Oh, wow.
it started out, send me a few cars and tell me what you like. And
I
the
assume he
next
has
thing
a
you know,
website.
I'm on third order,
I assume he has a website.
He does centerpiecerollingstock.com.
Yeah, that's a link you ought to put on the podcast group also. I think we'd all like to take a peek at that.
Yeah, he does really great work, and I would like to weather my own cars, and no, I can. I have in the past, and it was just like one of these things where
You
I
have
like
so
taking
many to
photos and
do,
I like doing
probably.
scenery. Yeah. So if you like taking photos and you like doing scenery and you're getting done and you don't have enough weathered cars, it kind of runs into a problem where you can't take a great photo if you have a shiny, bright car on the layout.
No
So.
question about it. No question about it. And when I was before, when I back in the 90s, when I was writing a lot of articles and all that, a lot of my stuff was about how to take a particular prototype car that grabbed my attention and replicate it. You know what I mean? So the interesting thing is, other than new stuff that I bought, I came into this phase of the layout with a pretty good roster of already weathered stuff. And naturally, I've weathered things in the interim, but I've also farmed it out as much as I can. The guys like Neil Schofield and Mike Confalone and Karlowitz has done some weathering for me and some structures. There's just so much to do here that when you've got modeling peers, people that you trust, there's no downside to getting their input
No,
on things. And that way,
there
everything
isn't.
looks a little different too, which is also good, I think.
I believe so. Yeah, I believe that can help. And I started thinking about that aspect when I've started getting some of the weathered cars back, because I probably wouldn't, would have been so in control of that part of the, modeling itself. It was nice to have a different touch on there, somebody else's idea of what, and there were times I gave him prototype photos with the locomotive or a car that he was weathering. And then there was other times when I told him, I said, you're an artist. What you do, take a look at it and give me your rendition of what you think it looks should look like weathered. And he never let me down,
Right,
so.
right. A guy like that is gold, really.
And especially that he loves the Lehigh Valley. He lives on in along in Ulster, along the old Lehigh Valley line, along the port, part of the line you model also. So I couldn't beat that. How could I turn that down at that point, Yeah,
No,
so.
that's great. Well, Ron, I really appreciate you coming on and chatting with me, and something tells me we'll end up doing this again because I think we could talk all day.
Oh yeah, it's been fun.
Interesting stuff, and I would ask you to post the link to your stuff on the podcast group because people are going to want to be looking at this.
Sure.
And in parting, I just want to say that I hope this gives everybody a much needed diversion from all the stuff that's going on now. I've had a hard time this week getting my creative hat on to do everything that I wanted to do. And basically, any modeling I've been doing is just gluing tie piles together, about the most mindless thing you can do just to kind of cool the circuits. But I just hope everybody is going to stay safe, take it seriously, and we'll get through this. And you know what? Model railroading is a perfect hobby for this time.
Definitely.
All right, folks, until next time.